Not too bad. It's only one object in the world, it's your breath. Come to the golden room. Don't let your mind leave the golden room. Look at the sky outside the window. There. stay with this guy. Be contented to stay with this guy. Then drop your gaze to the mountains across the valley, lit with the last light of the day. And bring your mind into the golden room. Ask your dear, sweet heart teacher to come. And feel their hands on your hands. That's all. The meditation object is the touch of their hand on your hand. Focus on that. Keep the mind there, not with a struggle, but by enjoying this sacred touch on your head. Don't lose the touch on your hands. Use your iron hook and your chain. Bring the mind back. And enjoy. The only thing in the world is the touch of your teacher's hand. Touch of your teacher's hand. Then bring yourself back to this room. Slowly open your eyes. In my experience, the few hours after meals is not a good time to meditate. It's difficult. It's like yoga. And I don't know, I think for about 15 years, I didn't eat dinner. I didn't eat afternoon, or I didn't eat after lunch. And so evening was a pretty good time to meditate. But in three-year retreat, we found out that the quality of meditation degrades very quickly as you get closer to bedtime. Okay? Like it just goes down very sharply. The length of time you can meditate goes down very sharply, I don't know, in the evening for most people. So don't fight it, you know, don't try. What we've been trying to do this week was to start with a very short, high-quality meditation and not worry about the length of the meditation. We weren't trying to pile up minutes meditating. We were trying to make it high-quality. And then the length will come by itself. You see, it did today, right? This afternoon it came by itself. We weren't trying, I didn't set a goal to like, oh, let's increase it to 20, 25 minutes or something. But it came because the quality was good. Okay, so if you, I don't know about you, just now I felt the quality wasn't so good for myself. And then I was like, oh, I'll fight this, you know. And I'm going to not stop before 20 minutes or 25 minutes. And then that's a bad idea. Okay, if you're tired, if you just ate, if it's been a long day, if you still have part of a cold, then wrap it up, you know, and get to bed early, you know, take care of yourself and have a better one tomorrow, okay? What I mean is don't get in the habit of having a bad meditation. Don't get in the habit of having a low quality meditation, because that's what happens to almost everybody who tries to meditate. They go on for an hour and it's all low quality and then they get used to it. And then they don't really ever have good meditations. They don't know what it even feels like, you know? So, say, oh, you can't say. They call Kupa Utsu. Kupa, the people on the China tour know Kupa. Kupa means the idiot. Utsu means, insistence. Idiot insistence. Kupa Utsu. So, Kupa Utsu, don't do Kupa Utsu with your meditation. You know, don't just sit there and say, I'm going to go for 10 o'clock whether I'm on the object or off. You know, that's like the opposite. Stay on the object and then, you know, if it's 10 minutes, okay. If it's an hour, okay. If it's 5 minutes, okay. Just stay on the object. If you find you can't stay on the object, then stop. Because it just gets a bad habit. It gets subtle dullness or gross dullness, or probably even forgetting the object. Like, I think in a lot of cases it gets worse than dullness. What's worse than dullness? Just losing the object. Just spending the whole meditation time thinking about something else. You know? And then you get in that habit. And then you sit down to meditate, you close your eyes, and you start thinking about something else right away. Because you have the habit of it, you know. And then you stop even noticing that you're off the object. I'm speaking from personal experience. Okay. All right. Here we go. Ne shipa dembe dendya dembe tutel nyepa ni. So, okay, Nick. So he's not the Nick. If he's not the Nick, if he's not the one Nick who is the sum total of his parts, which we just finished that. That was point number three. So we're at the point number four. Is Nick his parts? Is Nick somehow divorced from his parts? Is there a Nick who's independent from his parts? Okay. So here we go. I should rather say
who is his passport. Here we go. Data chikta ngepa la tene. Once you get it straight that there can't be just one big Nick, daktam pumbo ni rashingi dupe tade le wu min du nyamna, well, then you might figure to yourself, well, if there's not one big Nick who owns the parts, then I guess he would have to be the parts themselves. Okay? If there's not a Nick who owns the body and owns the mind, then I guess the body and the mind must be Nick. Okay? The plurality is Nick. Okay? Mm. Du means it couldn't rightfully be anything else. Wu normally means to be worthy. Okay? Wu shok is a ballot, a voting ballot, a worthiness paper. Okay? Alright, so Umen Du means it wouldn't be right. Nothing else would be right except for Nick to be plural if he weren't the big boss of all his parts. Okay? Because he's got to be related to the parts somehow. He's either related to the parts or he's not related to the parts. If he's related to the parts and he's not the big boss, then he can only be the parts. Okay? Umen Du Nyamna, Wona. So suppose then that there is a Nick who was separate from his parts. Sashele, Aryanagarjuna's root text on wisdom says, Dagni niwa lemba le shenyi tepa mayante shenyi yina lemme par sungyu rignang sungdume chepatar. Dagni niwa lemba le shenyi tepa mayante. It's not correct to say that Nick could be anything separate from his parts. Okay? It's not correct to say that Nick could be anything separate from his parts. Tepamayante, sheni yina len mepar. The parts in Tibetan, the word for parts here being that which he took on at birth. The parts which he took on at birth. If Nick were somehow separate, from the parts which he took on at birth, then there wouldn't have been any taking and there wouldn't have been any holding because there would be nothing to hold. Right. So that's Aryanagarjuna. Here's the explanation of it. Raluk lang sumle raluk ni lok sukawa shudu lang di she tungyu yupatar. This is, I don't know if you appreciate what Tibet is the repository of the highest knowledge of mankind for the last 1,000 years, okay? Seriously. And before Buddhism got there, they were all yak herders, okay? There was no writing. They didn't have a written language. They were all just sitting on the sides of, barren 25,000 feet high mountain, rocks. Herding a few goats and sheep and yaks, and that was it. So a lot of the examples you find in scripture relate to critters. Okay? So Ra Luk Lang Sum, suppose you got a goat, a sheep, and a cow. Okay? Suppose you got a goat, a sheep, and a cow. And then you take out the goat and the sheep. Well, what do you got left? You guessed it. A cow. So, like, if you got these three critters and you take away two of them, then you end up with a cow, right? So, but is it also that way with the five parts to a person's persona, the person? What are the five parts? We'll go over them one more time. Like, sub, sorva, duche, demiduche. Namshe, right? So suk means the physical parts of a person, which are the body of the person. Okay? The physical parts of a person. Suk is the first skanda or heap. Why are they called heaps? Why are the parts of a person called heaps? Pumdang gego reki dung pumbo keje kamnangin, first chapter of Abhidhamma Kosha. They're called heaps because they are piles of different things, like the the heap of the body is composed of all the arms and leg, and you know, it's a pile of stuff. So they're called piles or skandhas. We're just saying parts of the person, okay? But be aware that each part is made of many components, and that's why they're called piles. So could you do the same exercise with the five parts of a person? Well, let's do the five parts. Your physical body, your feelings, your capacity to divide between things or discriminate between things, okay? Number three. Number four, the other functions of your mind, which are, you know, what are they, 51 or, depends on what school you're in, 46, something, I think that's it. There are certain functions of the mind. So then the Abhidharma says, why did they take two of the functions out and make them separate heaps? Why did they just say body and mind? Why did they say body and feelings, discrimination, other functions of the mind and consciousness? Why did they split them out? Korwe gyuchir, in gyuchir, pumbo namne, tsoradan, dushi loshi pumbo shark. That's the first chapter of Abhidharma also. We separate out two of the heaps, feeling and discrimination, because they are the cause of our suffering. I like how that feels, so I like him. I like him because he makes me feel good. I don't like her because she doesn't make me feel good. Okay? So we divide based on feelings. We make discriminations based on feelings. So because those two mental functions are the root of all suffering, they are, in the study of the parts of the person, they are separated out into their own categories because they're so important in causing suffering. So is it the case that as we did with the sheep, the goat, and the cow, that we could just take out of the room the body, the feelings, the discrimination, the other mental functions, and raw awareness itself, and then would we find Nick? Okay? That's the question. Is there a Nick which is separate from his pieces? Okay. And we're getting more sophisticated than saying Nick and his arms and legs, right? We're saying Nick, his body, his feelings, his capacity to discriminate, the other parts of his mind, and his capacity for awareness at all. Okay. If we strip away the five parts, the five classical parts of a person, will we find Nick? Will Nick be left over in the way that the cow is left over when we take away the goat and the sheep? That's all. Got it? Okay. Yeah, and Akasha is saying, no, it doesn't work that way. It's not the case. There doesn't. So the ergo, there doesn't seem to be an independent Nick who is independent from his parts. Okay? Because it's not like the sheep and the goat and the cow. Okay? Which reminds me of the rabbi and the goat story, but we don't have time for that. There's lots of good stories in the diamond business. Dushe duche namshe desu pumbulunu. Ngao shepe pumbodan jame chik ngu jingyu gubala deta ngu sundu mebatan. So you would expect that if Nick were somehow, if there were a separate Nick who owned his parts, because that's what we really think, right? Nick's leg, Nick's ear, Nick's mind. Then Nick must be something different than Nick's ear, right? He must somehow be the possessor of all of them, right? So, but if we eliminate one by one all those parts, then we try to find a Nick, we can't find one. Okay. Okay. Sashele, kelte pumbo namle shen, pumbo tseni mepar gyoshe patar. Then he starts listing problems with this idea that there's a Nick who is separate from his parts. Okay? Sashele, kelte pumbo namle shen, pumbo tseni mepar gyor. If Nick were something other than his five classical parts, then he would lack the defining quality, the defining characteristics of those parts, okay? What does that mean? Here's the explanation. And you have to know Abhidharma to appreciate it. Dharma pumbo duche su tsumbe tsenyi kenjik so min denba tang pumbo la kega nachi chungwa yanda yang dakla kega nachi so min chungwa tang. So, in the Abhidharma, they describe the defining characteristics of a changing thing, okay? The defining characteristics of a changing thing. Changing things are big in Buddhism, right? Because everything's changing. Everything's impermanent, right? So there are certain qualities that if you see them in a thing, you can say it's unchanging. All changing things exhibit certain qualities. Okay, what are they? Here are some. Senyi ken jig sok min denba. Ke wa jigpa. Starting and stopping. Starting and stopping. Then he said la sopa, and you got to really appreciate that he's a master of Abhidharma. He said, and so on. Because in Abhidharma there's a big debate. Because some schools of Abhidharma say all changing things exhibit three modes. Starting, staying, and stopping. And then some more radical Abhidharma schools say, come on, things don't really stay, do they? For even an instant, there's no staying. There's just starting and stopping. Okay. And then people say, oh, well, Buddha taught that there were three, starting, staying, and stopping. And then the reply comes, well, he was just trying not to freak people out. Okay. But in truth, everything is dying from the moment it starts. Okay? Everything is stopping from the moment it starts. The starting of a thing kills it. The birth of a human being kills the human being. You know? So Buddha was careful not to emphasize staying, because people would get complacent. They'd say, well, at least I can stay for a while. You know? But then Buddha said, let's cut out the staying. Because lots of kids die in the womb. They don't get to stay. Okay? Like that. Okay? So anyway, then there's beautiful debates in the Abhidharma, if you really want to know, which you don't, but it's okay, about whether the starting has a starting and a stopping, and whether the starting stays at all. And then it gets pretty wild, but I won't go there. Kenji so min denba, pumbo la kega nachi chunyan, da la kega na. So, Aryanagarjuna is saying, if you were separate from your parts, if there were a nick that we could find after we had taken away the sheep and the cow, you know, the sheep and the goat, if there were a nick that we could find like that, then he wouldn't exhibit the qualities that his parts exhibit, meaning he wouldn't stop and start. He would be eternally there. He would never get more or less nick. Okay? Because he's independent from those changing things. You take away the changing things, he's still there. Like the cow is still there after you take away the sheep and the goat, okay? So then his nature would be radically different from the nature of his parts. The nature of his parts is to exhibit these defining qualities of a changing thing, starting, stopping, staying. So if he were completely independent of those parts, it'd be like when my mom used to say, soul, your soul. And then you'd say, Mom, what do you mean by soul? And they would say, well, it's a part of you inside of you that doesn't change. And it goes to heaven after you die. So that's how I was brought up. I don't know how you heard soul. I don't know what kind of soul thing they gave you. That's the one I got. And I had a feeling for a long time about what my soul was. It was like a core of my being. And like a little stone inside my body, and you know that would not die when the body died. Like that, there was a part of me that was a core part of me that was still Mike. That after I died, it would be safe somewhere, and it would go somewhere, and you know, it eternally be okay. So this Nick begins to sound a little bit like that, I think. If you say he's not, if you say there's a Nick beyond his mind and body, then I guess you could might say soul, and it would also not exhibit the qualities of mortality and the qualities of worldly impermanence. It would be somehow transcendent from the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. You know what I mean? It would be above all that, and it wouldn't change. Okay? So it's similar to what we're saying here. If there were a Nick that you could find after you took away all his changing parts, then that Nick would have to be like unchanging, eternal, would not exhibit the qualities of mortality. Also, since you're the parts of any given person exhibit the qualities of the famous Buddhist qualities of Keganachi. So say Keganachi in your mind. Okay? Oh, you got the chi wrong. Keganachi, okay? Keganachi is very, very famous. These are the four sufferings of life. Okay? Ke is to be born. To be born is suffering. You don't remember because it's been a while. But it was a hassle. Okay? They were squishing your head and everything. Ga is getting old, which started the day you were born. Na, the illness that comes to people, sickness. And then Chiwa, death. So these are the four great sufferings that Buddha's Lord Buddha came to help us overcome. Keganachiso. If Nick were totally divorced and independent of his parts, then since those parts have Keganachi, he wouldn't have Keganachi because he's radically different. He's radically above. He transcends his parts. He owns the parts. Nick's body, Nick's mind. So Nick is some kind of eternal, unchanging, crystalline thing. I used to think his soul is crystalline a little bit. And he's like some crystalline thing. And he would not exhibit Keganachi. Okay? Nick would never die. Nick would never get old. Nick would never get sick. His body would. And his mind would. But since he is separate from them and transcends them and owns them, he wouldn't exhibit those. Okay? Nick's body would get old, but Nick wouldn't. All right? Also, this is very famous in examining the relationship between things. Okay? Penne means either help or hurt. And oftentimes it's physical. Okay? So pen would be like give somebody a massage. Ne would be like punching them. Okay? So if Nick were substantially independent or different from Nick's parts, then you could stick a knife in the body and it wouldn't hurt Nick because they're not related substantially, okay? Or you could give a massage to the body and Nick wouldn't necessarily feel good because Nick's is above all that. Nick owns the body and he's separate from the body. So if the body, if you could hurt or harm his body, and Nick wouldn't feel anything either way. If he were essentially separate from his body and mind, which we've decided is necessary because we already decided he wasn't the same as, okay? If you remember. Okay. You can look this part over again for about 23 years. And you'll figure it out. This is very, very important for those of you who want to be, you want to understand scripture. You've got to learn this expression. Okay? Jikten means the world, loka. Jikten is a translation of loka, which comes from roach, which means to shine. Okay? They're from the same root. Okay. Loch and Roch. So I guess Sanskrit was invented by a Thai person. But anyway, Jikten means... No, I had an office in Thailand. I had to start an office in Thailand. And we had three main suppliers of rubies and sapphires. And they were real gems, Lear gems, and rare gems. But when the secretary called me, she'd say, Lil gems is here. Because all the R's and L's are, you know, Lil gems. So I'd say, which Lil gems? You know? So anyway, R's and L's are what do you call it? Interchangeable in Sanskrit. In general, they're interchangeable in Sanskrit. So anyway, Mingel means Jigten means loka. Tanyedu means in the parlance of the world. Okay? In the parlance of the world. Parlance is a really beautiful word for Tanya here. In the normal speech of the world. In the normal usage of the world. We say things like Nick got sick. Or we say, Nick got cut, right? And we say things like, Nick has changed since yesterday. And we say things like, Nick was born. So in the parlance of the world, we can say those things. But that doesn't mean that the word Nick got old, or the word Nick got caught, or the word Nick, you know, exhibited the quality of starting or stopping. You see what I mean? In the way we normally view Nick, you could say Nick got caught, but then you don't see Nick change to ick. You see what I mean? No, I'm serious. I'm serious. When you say Nick got cut, you mean Nick's body got cut, right? You don't mean Nick got cut. Right? Nick is something else. Right? When you think about it, it's not that Nick got cut, it's that Nick's body got cut. Okay? Or when you say Nick got upset, it's not that Nick got upset, it's Nick's mind got upset. Okay? If Nick was body and mind together, then when Nick got upset, his body would get upset. Or when you cut his finger, he'd forget six words. You see what I mean? Seriously. Okay, so he's not, his body and mind aren't mixed together, but we tend to think there's some kind of Nick above his body and mind who owns them. And we think of that Nick as undamageable. You don't say ick or Nick got caught, you know, like that. Nick is the same. Nick is a word, Nick is an idea, and Nick lasts from the time he's born to the time he dies. And you don't change the word, you don't call him Nick in 1983 or Nick in 1996. Or, you know, it's just Nick. Okay? He's going to get sick of this. Anyway. Pumbo mepe shila, shilang. Now, so, anyway, you are contradicting the parlance of the world if you say that, if you go around saying Nick's body got hurt, Nick's body got cut. Right? The common parlance of the world says what? Nick got cut. Okay? And that implies some kind of connection between Nick and his parts. Because actually only his body got cut. Okay? So you say, we don't have to say Nick's body got cut. We just say Nick got cut because everybody understands that Nick's body is part of Nick. Or Nick's body is Nick. But then this guy who's presenting part four, he said, I decided that Nick is separate from his parts. Then you would be contradicting how the whole world talks about Nick. Very, 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 very famous, okay? You're all too young. Was anybody around during Woodstock? Okay, anyway. So there's this guy, Max Yasger, right? It's very famous. They're, you know, they expected like a couple hundred people to show up at this rock festival. And then a million or something showed up, like a half a million people showed up. And they all took off their clothes and smoked dope and stuff like that. And then they were having a really good time. And then this guy got up. The guy who owned the... They did it. They held an event on some farmland, some meadows, some huge meadows. And so I don't know why they were bored between acts or something. And somebody put the guy, the owner of the farm, they got him up on the microphone to say hi. And he's got these suspenders on, and he's this old chubby fat guy, you know. And he gets up after Jimi Hendrix and before Janis Joplin, you know. And he grabs the mic and he says, he's scared to death, you know. He's like, 500,000 people are staring at him. And he's like, I'm Max. I'm a farmer. And then everybody, you know, they roared, you know. They roared for him, you know. Why am I talking about that? Somebody asked Arya Nagarjuna one time, what school of philosophy do you represent? And he said, I'm a farmer. That's all. He said, Nashimbayi, I'm a farmer. And then people said, well, what do you mean? And he said, whatever farmers say, I also say. You know? What do farmers say, Nagarjuna? Farmers say if you plant a seed, a plant will grow. That's it. Nothing more complicated than that. I'm a farmer. Whatever farmers say, I say too. And I'm never going to contradict the farmers. You know, don't expect me to contradict a farmer. Whatever a farmer says is okay with me. You know? And then people were just blown away. They were hoping for some, you know, new school of philosophy. And all he said was, I go along with whatever farmers say. That's called Jigden Gitanyi. That's the parlance of... What he meant was parlance of the world. If a farmer says a plant grows from a seed, I also use that language and I believe it. You know? If people in the world choose to say Nick got cut, rather than saying Nick's body got cut, that's fine with me. And you shouldn't contradict the parlance of the world. Or you're getting unreal. So here it says, Jigden Gitanyi Dang Tani Duma Dang Gyal. Gyal means contradict. Okay? So if you try to say there's a Nick who's independent of his body and mind, then you're gonna be disagreeing with farmers. The expressions you used and the words you use will contradict the way farmers talk. And that's an allusion to Nagarjuna. Then you're contradicting who? I mean, you're basically, if you contradict the parlance of the world, you are contradicting the person who brought emptiness to this world. You know? That's what they're, I mean, if you know, then that's, it's a heavy accusation to say to somebody, you are contradicting the way the world talks. Okay? All right? Whatever you decide, whatever you come up with in your search for ultimate reality should be expressible in the common words of the world, or you have it wrong. Okay? You should be able to express it in common, understandable language, like the pen thing, you know, without reference to schools of philosophy. In fact, in China, we had this thing, you know, we can't be religious there. I can't wear robes, we can't talk about religious subjects. We have to stick to business and relationships. But we speak about emptiness extensively, and we speak about karma extensively. We don't use the words. And people get it. We are just using the language of the world, and that's the way it should be. Okay? Anyway, Pumbo Mepe Shila Angao Nyamba Jungwa Gyur. If there was a Nick who owns his body and mind, then in a place where his body and mind aren't, we should be able to have a Nick sometimes, if we want. Okay? If there's a Nick who owns his body and mind, which means who is independent from his body and mind, then we could say Nick's over there, even when his body and mind are over here, because he's independent of them. He doesn't depend on them. So you could say Nick could be over there when his body and mind are over here. All right? You get what I should do. Le chepa chusawa dang, ma chepa dang You would also have the logical, what do they call in English? You can't say. Logical problem, right? Kyun, in Tibetan is kyun. Logical problem. Why? You could also have a case where a person committed a karma and never had to experience its result. It just went away. Okay? Somebody did something and there was no, what do you call it? Payback. A karma without a payback. All right? A boomerang that never flew back. Okay? That's what you would have if there were a Nick who owned his body and mind, separate from his body and mind in the way that the cow is separate from the sheep and the goat. Okay? Also, then there would have to be Nicks who encountered consequences of their actions that they hadn't committed. Consequences of actions that they hadn't committed, which are both unfair and not allowable. Okay, Gyawasam Narshin, as we mentioned earlier. Okay, Soki Nerje Duma Juan. Nerje is a good, nice word. Nerje means harmer, and it means problems with a position. Harmer means problems with a position. In Buddhist logic. Okay, meaning, if you say Nick is not his body and mind, if you say there's a big Nick who owns his body and mind, then there's lots of things that hurt that idea. There's lots of things you could bring up that would disprove that idea. Okay? Boy, you guys are sleepy. It's going to get worse. Should I do this? I think we'll keep going. Dapu Marangshingi, Jibetadi, the Me, Takche, Re, Nyamdu, Nyepa, Nyepa, Ni. So you should decide in your mind right now that there's no Nick who is separate from his body and mind. There isn't any Nick. So we have a problem here, okay? You have to try to appreciate it. These last few, these are hard, and I went through them because they're in the book. If I had, you know, if I wasn't going straight through a book, I would have skipped them or something. I wouldn't have talked about them. But I feel like I'm supposed to be giving you the whole transmission of a certain book. These last few pages are very difficult, and it's hard to make them relevant. But what I would say is, go back to the pen. Somebody give me a pen. Go back to the pen. Just go back to the pen. When you're not sure, go back to the pen. Is the pen coming that? Is the pen coming that way or this way? Yeah, I'm. Something in my mind is creating the pen. Why? Because when a puppy dog comes in, they don't write with it, or they don't even try. They just chew on it. Okay, so that means they don't see a pen. They see a chew toy. Right? So it means the pen is not announcing itself. It means the pen must be coming from me. Okay, just remember that. Does it appear naturally to normal people that the pen is coming from the pen? To normal people, if I said, Is penness coming from the pen? They would say, yeah. They wouldn't say pen is made up by my mind or something like that. Okay. If I held it up, I'd say, is this a pen? They'd say, yeah, it's a pen. I say, where is it coming from? They say, well, it's just a pen. It's coming from itself. You know. They don't think that they're creating the pen as they go. On the fly? What's that thing in programming? On the fly? I think it's on the fly. It's doing calculations on the fly. They don't think it's your mind creating the thing on the fly, okay? But there does appear a pen that comes from its own side, right? That, now get this. I'm not going to let you be sleepy, okay? Get this. There's an appearance of a pen that comes from its own side coming from the pen. There is an appearance of a pen that came from its own side that's flowing from the pen. And from my side, there's an old bad habit that accepts that appearance. Okay? There's something, there's a lie coming from the pen, and there's an acceptance of the lie coming from me, and they meet in the middle somewhere, and then I believe the pen came from itself. Why does this matter to you? The next person who yells at you, whether it's your spouse or your lama, you have to think they're not coming from themselves. They're coming from me. Why? I must have yelled at someone before and planted a seed in my mind, and that's why I'm seeing them yell. Well, if you don't like people yelling at you, what should you do? Well, you can start by not yelling back. Okay? Do you not yell back because it's a noble thing not to yell back? No. Do you not yell back because they're not stupid? No, they're stupid. Okay? All bosses and husbands are stupid. You know that. Okay, you know that. It's just that if you call them stupid, then you'll have people calling you stupid for weeks. So it's just a matter of self-preservation. It's not noble or right or moral, or it's just unpleasant to have people yelling at you all the time. So don't yell back, okay? Then you stop them. Anyway, so we've been examining. Have we been examining whether a pen is the sum total of its parts? Sorry. Have we been examining whether a pen is is the sum collection of its parts, or whether it owns those parts, or something like? Have we been examining that? Have we been examining whether a pen is related to its parts? Be careful. You gotta go back to what we were talking. You see, we're not actually talking. The question has not been, for these many painful hours, whether the pen was the sum of its parts. That wasn't the question. The question was whether what you think the pen is the sum of its parts. Okay? You know, I'll say it again. Is the pen, which is coming from its own side, you know, I'm already, your mind should say, right there, your mind should say, but Geshe-la, that doesn't exist. Now you want to examine how it relates to the world? You know? How does an honest politician relate to the world? You know? There's no use talking about it. There's no such thing. Okay? So, we've been examining whether the pen that comes from its own side was one with its parts, or wasn't one with its parts, and the whole discussion was fruitless because it doesn't exist. Okay? It can't be the same as its parts. We can discuss whether Nick has his parts, but that's not what we've been discussing. We've been discussing whether the Nick who came from his own side was one with his parts, which is a useless discussion. Because either way you take it, it's going to be wrong. Okay? Is the Nick which comes from his own side one thing or many things? You should say, okay? It's a dumb question. There's no such thing. Okay? What's the example in Scripture? Two famous examples in Scripture. Is a rabbit with antlers, are the antlers on a rabbit's head 6 inches long or 12 inches long? And then you should just say, okay? Is a flower which grows in midair with no means of sustenance, no earth, no water, no sunlight, no seed, does it smell good or bad? You see, those are famous examples in Scripture. What's our example? A Nick who came from his own side. Why are we interested in that? Because Nick got blamed for stealing. That's how we got here. That's how we came. This came. Nick got blamed for stealing books. Okay? And then And then Nick had this big extra Nick who didn't deserve to get played. Right? And that Nick was the same as Casper the Ghost. There was no Nick like that. And it got bigger and bigger the more he got blamed for stealing the books. Okay? Thus the Nick who got blamed wrongly for stealing the books, right? Is he one with his parts or is he separate from his parts? Yeah, I mean, Deshla, just save me the last. Could you just put the other five pages away? Like, just take him out of the book. And future generations won't have to go through this two last couple of days. We'll just put a little note there that says, you know, this Nick never existed anyway. So we're going to skip the discussion of whether he's one or not with his parts. Got it? Because if you're going to look into whether Nick is one with his parts, well, then that's he is. He is the sum of his parts. Okay? He is. There is a Nick which is the sum of his parts. Okay? That's all. But not the Nick that didn't deserve to get blamed. Okay? No such thing. Hopefully we're at the end of these four parts. Let's see. How are we doing on time? Am I supposed to stop at 9:30, right? No. Huh? What's it say over there? 9:30? Did it say 9:30? Okay. Let's do some questions, okay? And then I'll hit you with some more. Let me see if we got anything else here. I don't even remember. Data garchang is in Nansa de Shela Shatam. Nashang and then make it and then yeah, let's stop there. Okay. Who's picking? Is Giselle picking? Okay. This is a Pandit's hat. Seriously, Pandit's hat were designed with a single point on the top. Why? It represents ekagra. That's why those skinny, we call them dunce hats. Whoa, that's a good question. Can we, there are 9 levels of meditation. There are 5 problems in meditation. But nowhere in the poster did they actually link the problems to this 9, you know, the 5 problems in the 9th state. So could we do that? There's a reason why they didn't. Let's check. What's the first problem? Is not feeling like meditating. Here's another Nick question. Here's another Nick question. Which of the 9 levels would that relate to? Be careful. Where do you find the, on which of the 9 levels do you not feel like meditating? Again, there's no such thing. Because you're meditating by the first level is you're already in meditation. Very lousy, poor, fly on the cowpile meditation, but you're meditating. So to answer the question as far as problem number 1, that happens before the first level of meditation. How about the second problem, which was losing the object completely? That would happen all the way up to, what, the 4th level or something? Okay. You would lose the object completely, but in increasingly less times. In the first 2 stages, you're off it more than you're on it. So problem number 2 is occurring more than problem number 2 is not occurring. And then when you get to level 3, it starts to switch around. Okay. How about the third problem? What's the third problem? Chingunyi. Dullness and agitation. Okay. All the way up to there, right? All the way up to 8, is it? I think it's 8. Okay, all the way up to there you have them. Chuching jupe yiche, the mental mode where you are being harassed by and interrupted and, you know, this thing by dullness and agitation. I think it's up to 8, right? What about problem number 3? Failing to take action when you should have taken action. I would say we're still there, right? You could still say it applies even at nine, perhaps. If it's action to fix dullness and agitation, then only up to seven. Okay. Then what about overacting, like trying to fix it when it ain't broken? Seven and eight? I think it could happen almost anywhere, no? Like, you could be trying to fix dullness when you don't have dullness or something? I don't know. But yeah, mainly it's up high. It's up around eight and nine. When you're on cruise control, you shouldn't fool with the accelerator. Just leave things alone. It's cruising at its own speed. So it's true that in the scripture, they don't actually do this exercise, and it's a smart question. It's a really good question. It means the person is thinking about it. Their handwriting looks to me French. Am I right? Okay. There's a benefit to being on planes all your life. Okay. Let's do, yeah. Yeah. Okay, let's skip that part. Yeah, this is pretty bad. I like this one. I'll do the whole thing. Enormous thanks for your inspirational guidance. I will forever be in your debt. Number two, is it true that you only rarely get past meditation level number three? No, it gets better, it gets better. It gets better, it's really cute. I suspect that you are using this as an educational technique to place yourself at our level. However, I personally find it discouraging to know that after 20 or 30 years of meditation, it gets better. After 20, 30 years of meditating, and then in parentheses, properly and following the instructions, that I would still be at level three. And then it ends with, should I shoot myself now? You want me to be frank, I did have better meditation a long time ago. And I think it was Bhagchak Sepa. You see what I mean? It wasn't due to any efforts in this life. I think I came in with certain mental seeds. And they typically, those kinds of seeds ripen in the late teens and the 20s. And after that, you're on your own. Meaning, whatever efforts you make in this life. You see what I mean? So you get kind of the main debit credit, that if you've had a good past life, then the main time that you benefit from that, normally, in many aspects, is your late teens and your 20s. And then you're just running on the seeds that you've created in this life. And we don't normally create great seeds between, you know, in our high school years, say. No, seriously. It's not like you spend your high school years in deep meditation or something. Normally. You are enjoying the ripening of good seeds from your past life. So you drink and you party and you meet girls. And you see, that's good seeds ripening from your past life, but it's not creating any new good seeds. You see, that comes with just hard work. And the hard work doesn't start until you start the Dharma, right? Until someone teaches you meditation and you start working hard, you're running on past life seeds mainly. And those wear out. So personally in my own case, I think it was mostly past life seeds that I did have a extraordinary meditation in my 20s. And then after that, I was on my current life scene. So I had to overcome Washington High School scenes. Seriously. And I had to work back to this, to where I am now. So I, in my own case, that's what's happening. Some of the seeds from my past life, I think, are ripening now, late, and very beautiful, important things are happening. But, you know, so just be aware of that with your own self. You won't have great meditation until you've had time to collect the seeds for it, and that will take some time. Okay, so. All right. So yes, oftentimes I am on level 3 or less. Cool. This is a reaction to the statement that you are creating the pages of the book as you turn it, right? So if that's true, that as I turn the pages of a book, my mind is laying down the next words, which is the case, that's the case, then how did I come to write this book? You see, why am I hearing this book? If I'm the author, how could I have written this book? Because I don't understand it. Something like that. I mean, it's this high thoughts that I haven't thought about in my life. So how could it be that I've written it? That's not a big... You know that's not a big problem, right? Like, you did some extraordinary goodness. One of the cool things about seeing emptiness directly, which is not much talked about, is that the karma of seeing emptiness directly assures that you will never be without fantastic teachers, ever, again. Okay? Like, that's one of the cool side effects of seeing emptiness directly. It creates a special karma that you will never not be in the hands of very, very high teachers, you know. But you see, that's an example. You didn't set out to create the karma to be in the hands of high teachers. You did some extraordinary goodness, and that will manifest in multiple different ways. And one of them is teachers who know more than you could ever know. Okay, and it's not that you have to know that to manifest them. Okay, why? The seed is, you know, shikwa. Shikwa seed is always smaller than the shikwa. Shikwa means watermelon, right? It was very popular in the DCI talks in China. Because people really relate to watermelons in China. People eat them. Dessert in China is a piece of watermelon. It's not like 6 pieces of pie or something. they relate to shikwa. So it's possible that you have done a slight kindness to someone else to help them understand something, and that has created a text which is beyond your ken, which is beyond your understanding, okay? Because shikwas grow from small seeds. Okay? That's okay. That's easy. How about one more? These are fun and the book is hard. This one has a Buddha on it. Okay, good. It's a nice question. I am having an experience that I'm not sure where it fits into the map. When I am focused on my teacher, I feel a rush of energy. This initially feels wonderful. However, soon my body tightens down and I feel like I'm having a seizure. This feels like too much, so I have been softening my intensity when I begin to feel the rush, but then I slip into what feels like a dullness by comparison. Does that rush have any place in where we are trying to go? Is there a way to ride the rush without having a seizure? This is why we've been doing yoga, okay? I mean, this is what in the yoga we've been talking about the inner body, and the very most important, probably the most important teaching on the inner body, which is given in the Tibetan tradition of yoga, is Lumsam Jupa Chipa, right? So you've heard that. You can't say it. Dang. Lumsam Jupa Chipa. Lung means prana. Lung means the chi in your body. Sam means your mind, your thoughts. Jupa Chipa means they always ride in tandem. They always come in tandem, okay? Your thoughts are always tied to your prana, and your prana is always tied to your thoughts. Your prana is like the horse, and the thoughts are like the horse rider. And it's an interesting relationship if you reflect on it. Sometimes the horse is the boss, and sometimes the rider is the boss, right? I mean, people said, "Oh, Geshe-Mapa, you're from Arizona." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Oh, you must be good with horses." I said, "Yeah, I rode them twice." You know? And they said, "Well, why only twice?" I said, "Well, the first time they gave me this half-dead animal that it was old and they put a saddle on it and they put me on there and it kind of like, I don't know, tottered down the trail. And it was a good time. I rode on. I was scared. But I rode on it. I was like 10 or something. And then later in college, somebody put me on a racehorse. And it took off. And then I just went like this, you know. And then it stopped right there. And then I flew like an amazing distance. And then I never got on a horse again. So sometimes the horse directs the show. And then in theory, the rider can tell the horse where to go. And it's the same with the inner body. So because Lungsam Jupa Chipa, because the prana and the thoughts ride in tandem, and the thoughts are riding on the prana, you can direct the prana with your thoughts. So in Nigumas Yoga, you direct the prana to the inside of the chakras by focusing there, okay? And then that brings the prana there. But the opposite is also true. So normally the horse rider tells the horse where to go. But the principle behind yoga in Tibet and in ancient India is that you take advantage of the relationship to direct the thoughts by directing the prana, see? So you direct the prana through certain movements, asanas, and then knowing which channels relate to which emotions, you can elicit emotions by moving prana, okay? So in that case, you're moving the horse to move the rider. You get the horse to go right, and the rider, being on the horse, has no choice but to go right. Okay, so you can work the relationship both ways. Okay, what does it have to do with meditation? In meditation, you are focusing the mind in a way which it is never focused in normal life. Okay, you are bringing the mind in, pratyahara. You are focusing the mind inwards, which has a corresponding effect on the prana. Okay, if you concentrate the mind inward, if you draw the mind inward to a core, then that's necessarily drawing the prana also into a core because of Lungsam Jupa Chipa, because they ride in tandem. If the horse is brought into the middle of the barn, the rider must come. So in meditation, the rider is going into the middle of the barn, so the horse has to go with the rider. Assuming they're like glued together with crazy glue or something, okay? Which is the case. They're never separated. So when you focus the mind inward during meditation, it would be very much to be expected that you should have certain rushes caused by movements of prana. Because the prana is linked to the thoughts, which are now being concentrated into the core of the mind. So you would have some kind of, you could expect some rushes. You might feel jolts, or you might feel thrills up your spine, or you might get these things, you know, like that. And that's a normal result of the thoughts being concentrated. Okay, so when you're meditating on your teacher and you have some kind of rush of prana like that, whatever mistakes you make in the meditation, whatever dullness you have or whatever agitation you have, you'll have a corresponding pranic feeling in your body. Okay, so if you, for example, I believe the person who wrote it is over-concentrating the mind, right? And we talked about it. And that leads to subtle agitation. That leads to gross and subtle agitation. So I would say that the person has overly brought the mind in, and then there's been a reaction of the mind of over-excitement, stimulation, and then they've had a corresponding pranic experience. So how do you fix it? Which leads us to the question of lung, which we should talk about. We have 4 minutes. Lung is the Tibetan word for prana, okay? We should talk about it longer. I'll start tonight and we'll continue tomorrow. Lung is the Tibetan word for prana. It also means wind in Tibet. It's also the element wind. Like that. Those are the different meanings of lung. It's the word that the Tibetans chose to use to translate prana, the word prana. But if you know about the vayus, the five vayus in the yoga schools, there's not only a prana, there's all the prana of the body. When the body needs to do something, like digest food, or poop, or send blood out to the limbs, or cough, then prana, the general prana of the body, will collect in that area to perform its function. When the prana collects in a specific area to perform a bodily function, we call that a vayu. All those pranas joining together in a particular area of the body to enunciate words, for example, udana vayu. Those individual pranas collecting here, that becomes a vayu. Udana vayu, and that projects words, for example, or spit, or breath, exhalation of breath. So, what is it called? There's a thing called prana vayu, okay? You have to learn to distinguish between prana vayu and prana, okay? Prana vayu is one of the five wings around the heart area. But prana is all the energy in the whole body, okay? So prana vayu is different from prana, okay? Unfortunately, in Tibetan, they don't have separate words for prana and vayu. So they end up calling prana vayu the wind of wind. And prana is called wind. General prana is called wind. The vayus are also called wind. And the prana vayu is called the wind of wind. So it gets terrible. When you have a disorder, because you have concentrated the mind too strongly inside, without proper training, or without proper breaks, or without seeing some kind of vast sky or something, if you concentrate the mind in too far, you get a disorder which is also called lung. Okay, it's given the same name. The disorder of the wind is called the wind. So you can get the wind of the wind of the wind. And it's all called lung. And then it's really confusing. But luckily the Sanskrit words are all different. So anyway, a disorder of the pranavayu is called lung. And it comes from improperly meditating. Usually meditating too hard, trying too hard, concentrating the mind in too hard, without a feeling of expansiveness or pleasure. Okay? It's where you feel uptight. You are trying to meditate and you're uptight. And rather than feeling ngar, you are feeling anxiety that you haven't got 28 minutes of meditation done yet. You know? It's that. It's that kind of guilt and anxiety and nervousness. And then it manifests in a whole pile of different ways. The reason we've been doing the massages, for example, was to try to be proactive about that and try not to get people, not let people have it. That's why we've been getting up later than 4 o'clock. And that's a judgment call by the teacher. If the teacher sees that the students are all exhausted from 3 months of dying at Diamond Mountain, then they don't get up at 4 o'clock, because then everybody would get pranavayu disorder. So maybe the next retreat we will, when you're all recovered, but then you'll be exhausted from building the temple in Phoenix. So what the person is describing, the rush with their teacher, and could they ride the rush with their teacher? I would guess that the feeling of seizure that they described is the overactivity of the prana caused by too much concentration of the mind and feeling anxiety over meditating good enough or something like that. So then the fix for that would be some kind of spaciousness. So I would say, if I were having that kind of rush with my teacher, you know, in the visualization of my teacher, then I would try to lighten up. They described that they were lightening up, but then they felt it went into dullness. That's normal. You turn the wheel and you go too far, and then you come back. So you just have to get good at, what do you call it? There's a word, compensation, you know? Compensate. It's like when you do a twist and you take a, what do they call it? You take a twist to make up for the first twist. You hold this twist for 5 breaths, and then you do a bell. Anyway, I'll think of it by tomorrow. Counter twist. So you would have to do that with your mind, you see. You would have to do a counter. You have to keep doing counter twists, you know. So that person, I would say, I would guess that your main problem is trying too hard. And then look at the blue sky, look at the valley. Take yourself to the sky, the valley. That's why we do it in the room with the valley and the sky. Because whenever you feel a seizure coming on, you can look at the sky. And that's a traditional method of expansiveness. Counteracts is the counter twist to over concentration of the mind. Okay, so try that. And then when you start to get dull from that, come back to the golden room. Okay, so it's this thing. Okay, but definitely don't stay anywhere that's painful or causing anxiety. You gotta take action, right? If you stay in a place of anxiety or pain or trouble or feeling tightness in your chest and you don't take action, then you've committed problem number 4. Okay? You're required to do something about it. You're not allowed to sit in a meditation and feel bad. That's not allowed. You're supposed to do something. So that means you have to be able to diagnose your own problem and then give yourself a prescription, all right? And you should learn to do that. You should be able to diagnose, oh, I'm having subtle dullness. Now, what was the fix for that? Oh, I was supposed to uplift my mind. Well, how was I supposed to do that? Oh, you could either have just a mental image of golden light, or you could start thinking about how lucky you are. to be here and to have a teacher like that. Just thinking how lucky you are to have the teacher that you have should be enough to uplift you anytime. Okay? So like that, you got to know the problems and you got to know the antidotes, and that's why we're going through them. Okay. We'll come back to this difficult part of scripture tomorrow. Maybe it will change. Right? If you do yoga, it'll probably change. Good questions, though. Really good questions. Very classical questions. They've been asked for 2,000 years. Are you? Can you do it? Okay.
Sure.